The New Testament reading is taken from the book of Matthew, chapter 5, verses 21 to 48. This is found on page 1039 of your pew Bible. This reading is Jesus' words on the Sermon of the Mount. Beginning at verse 21. You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, "Do not murder." And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, "Raca," is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, "You fool," will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First, go and be reconciled to your brother. Then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you're still with him on the way, or he may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. I tell you the truth. You will not get out until you've paid the last penny. You have heard that it was said, "Do not commit adultery." But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness causes her to become an adulteress, and anyone who marries the divorced woman commits adultery. Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, "Do not break your oath, but keep the oaths you have made to the Lord." But I tell you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. Simply let your yes be yes, and your no, no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. You have heard that it was said, "Eye for eye and tooth for tooth." But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it is said, "Love your neighbor and hate your enemy." But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. These are the words of life. Heed them.
I am honored and pleased with the invitation to be with you today here at Park Street Church in Boston, to stand in the pulpit where my good friend and your very able senior pastor, Dr. David Fisher, stands and proclaims to you week after week the Word of God. I am grateful for that invitation and that trust, and I am honored to be in this place worshiping with you, sharing in this time of worship and celebration together. My wife Cheryl and I arrived in your beautiful city yesterday and were welcomed by Dr. Fisher and Mrs. Fisher to your very beautiful city. I have to admit, however, that I was somewhat confused by the welcome in that I grew up in South Florida. There were six children in my family, and we were brought up with specific responsibilities to do, chores, tasks to take care of. And my parents always taught me, you work first and then you play. You don't play until the work is done. But under the able leadership of your senior pastor, we reversed that yesterday and spent quite a bit of time playing and enjoying your beautiful city. By the way, I want to say that we were welcomed as we crossed the harbor by all of the tall ships that were there. You didn't really have to do that for me, but I am grateful nonetheless. But it was a joy to see David and Gloria again, to be with them. And it is equally a joy to be with you in worship. I bring greetings to you from your sister congregation south of you, the First Baptist Church of Raleigh, as we in that city and you here in this city strive together to be the people of God in our respective places. And so thank you for the invitation to be here. I am pleased to share. I am honored to share. Cognitive dissidence. It's a term often used in contemporary parlance, especially in psychological and educational disciplines. It's kind of a strange term, really, in that it is a feeling term that takes out a loan from the bank of intellect. It means the ambivalence and confusion that you often feel when expectation collides with experience. Cognitive dissidence. I remember when I was a kid growing up in South Florida, there was a television program about a family marooned in space. The title of the program, appropriately enough, was Lost in Space. And my favorite character in the program, as some of you who remember it might not be too surprised to hear, was the robot, the family robot. And whenever difficult situations arose, the robot would roll around on his caterpillar track feet, waving his arms wildly and shouting, "That does not compute! That does not compute!" Cognitive dissidence. I remember the first time cognitive dissidence made a real impression, shall we say, on me. I was in the sixth grade. It happened when my Christian faith and my Christian ethics, in which I had been scrupulously reared, ran smack up against a fellow sixth grader named Joe Goode. G-O-O-D-E. He was not. Joe was a big, rangy, blonde-haired boy from Michigan who towered over the rest of the sixth grade boys in our class, including me. His parents were migrant workers who followed the winter vegetable harvest to South Florida every year, and as a result, Joe, having been raised in that environment, was a tough kid, having seen the tougher side of life, which of course added to the mystique that gathered about him among us sixth grade boys there in South Florida. It was recess, as we used to call it, and we were playing football, which is a game in most places. It's a religion in Florida. I'd been brought up in the church. I had been taught the Christian ethic by my parents, by my Sunday school teachers, a significant part of which was turn the other cheek. That had been a part of the moral fabric out of which my own emerging ethical system had been fashioned. I have a brother who is 10 years older than I. He had an interesting spin on that. He used to say, "Love your enemies. It'll drive them crazy." Well, that seemed to me like, for all the world, good advice. And so I had tried to live up to that as best I could. But right there on the playground at Canal Point Elementary School in South Florida, cognitive dissidence sprang up and assaulted me.
In a dispute between Joe and me over what now I cannot remember, Joe threatened to punch my lights out. Everyone gathered around this little scene that was emerging there on the playground, including Mr. Threlkeld, who was our eighth grade history teacher, who was monitoring the playground that day. And so he came with all of the other students. They formed a circle around us, everybody gathering around to see the show. Joe put up his fists and walked around me in a threatening posture. I looked at him and said, and by the way, my beginner's Sunday school teacher, Mrs. Morrison, would have been proud of me. I looked at him and said, "Joe, fighting doesn't solve anything. I'm sure we can work this out. Besides that, I'm a Christian. I don't believe in fighting." Well, with that, all of the group that had gathered around us let out this audible, "Ah." You know, the little bloodthirsty savages had come to see a good brawl. They didn't want to hear this Christian stuff. But Joe, who apparently had missed the turn-the-other-cheek Sunday school lesson, drew back and smacked me right in the mouth. It was at that moment, when I was wiping the blood from my mouth, that the cognitive dissonance set in. And I remember thinking, what good is turn the other cheek if you're the only one playing? I mean, haven't they heard about the Sermon on the Mount in Michigan? What's going on here? That was my first real experience with cognitive dissonance, when the utter impracticality of the Sermon on the Mount was impressed upon me by Joe Goode. It was not to be the last. And on more than one occasion, the culprit which surfaced my cognitive dissonance, particularly in the area of ethics and behavior, turned out to be Matthew chapters 5 through 7, Jesus' sermon, the Sermon on the Mount. I think I was about 14. Yeah, I was about 14. Trying to make it through puberty, when I finally figured out what Matthew 5:29 was really talking about. You know, if your right eye offend you, pluck it out and throw it away. About 14 when I realized what that meant. And when I realized what it meant about this offensive eye, I knew I was in big trouble. I mean, what would I do? It was also about that time that I discovered general psychology. And I found out, not a moment too soon, I found out that it was utterly unrealistic for a 14-year-old, a normal adolescent, to be expected to use his or her eyes only for doing homework. I mean, that's unrealistic. What a relief it was to learn that psychology had given me permission to look every now and again with an offensive eye. It's a big word in some psychological circles, permission. And in a way, that's what I did with the rest of the Sermon on the Mount. Did you? I mean, have you read this stuff? You heard some of it read a moment ago. Can you believe that? Not only is murder wrong, but hating is wrong. Not only is adultery a no-do, but lust. And if someone smacks you right in the mouth on the playground, what you're supposed to say is, "Come on, you can do better than that." I mean, can you believe this? What a relief when my psychology professors in college gave me cogent-sounding explanations for my anger and my lust and my penchant to retaliate when someone strikes me on the cheek. I was greatly relieved. After all, they said, "You're only human, and anger and lust and good old healthy self-interest are the stuff of humanity. Don't be so hard on yourself." Or as my 16-year-old son says, "Dad, get real." That really is the problem, isn't it? The Sermon on the Mount isn't very realistic. It's just not very practical to try to do this. I mean, not in our kind of... It's a jungle out there. It's tough trying to do what Jesus told us we ought to do in the Sermon on the Mount in the real world where you and I live and breathe and earn our bread and make our living and have experiences and relationships. It's a jungle out there. I was comforted again when in seminary and graduate school I learned that even biblical scholars had trouble taking the Sermon on the Mount seriously. Martin Luther, as early as the 16th century, threw up his hands and said, "You can't live like this, not in our world. You just can't do that. Who can do that?" And so Martin Luther devised a more realistic interpretation of the Sermon on the Mount. Two kingdoms, he called it. Two kingdoms. You see, there are these two kingdoms in which the Christian finds himself or herself. The kingdom of this world, in which it is totally impractical to try to attempt to live out what the sermon teaches. And then there is the kingdom of God, the new world that God is bringing, the new world that is coming, in which it will then be possible to live what the Sermon on the Mount enjoins of us. Until that world comes, however, we should embrace the demands of the Sermon on the Mount only in our hearts, Luther taught. Live the sermon in your heart, but don't try to live it in the world. It won't work. Albert Schweitzer, about whom most people know only of his humanitarian medical work in Africa, but who before he began his medical career was also Germany's foremost interpreter of Bach, as well as being the preeminent New Testament scholar of his day, Albert Schweitzer also offered a realistic interpretation of the Sermon on the Mount. Schweitzer, noticing that Jesus spoke a lot about the coming age, the parousia was his word, the coming age, and who therefore attempted to take seriously the eschatological nature of Jesus' message, suggested that the ethical demands in the Sermon on the Mount constitute what Schweitzer called an interim ethic, a way to live in the time between the times, when God would send His Messiah to bring about a new world. But of course, Schweitzer thought that Jesus never believed Himself to be that Messiah, and so when Jesus died on the cross in an attempt, according to Schweitzer, to force God's hand in bringing this new world order, nothing more significant happened than a good, misguided Jewish radical died that day, like many others before him. And of course, the Sermon on the Mount, like most of what Jesus said and did and taught, was relegated to the dusty annals of first century Jewish history. Not one scholar has offered a serious interpretation of what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. Well, one has. Dietrich Bonhoeffer. His book, The Cost of Discipleship, is a study of discipleship in three parts, the second of which is an interpretation, a very serious, even radical interpretation of the Sermon on the Mount. I remind you, he was hanged for trying to take Jesus' words seriously. And so today, we come up with our own spin on the sermon. You can't live that way. Look again. You just can't live like that. You have heard that it was said by Jesus not to resist one who is evil, who wants to injure you. But I say unto you, you better look out for number one. Watch out for number one if you know what's good. Give them an inch. They'll take a mile. After all, doesn't the Bible say somewhere, God helps those who help themselves? Isn't that in there? Sure it is. Somewhere. Look again before you turn the other cheek. Look again before you go the second mile. Look again before giving to him or her who asks you. Look again. Look again, because how you look makes all the difference in the world. That's what Jesus is really arguing for, isn't it? A different way of looking, a new perspective on things. That's why he says, you have heard that it has been said, but I say unto you, hear that? Hear the polarity, hear the antithesis of that. Scholars call these sayings the antitheses of Jesus, where he sets one set of moral expectations over against another. You have heard that it has been said, but I say unto you, a lawyer who was asked how she could tell whether or not her clients were lying to her, said this, "Well, it's a little sad, but I begin with the assumption that everyone who comes into my office and sits down is lying to me. That's my basic assumption. I've learned the hard way they usually are. But if I discover in the course of dialogue and conversation that they're telling the truth, I'm pleasantly surprised. Expect the worst. You'll rarely be disappointed. But Jesus comes and calls for another way. Everyone who looks at a woman, or a man for that matter, lustfully has already committed adultery with him or her in their hearts. Jesus comes pleading for another way. Do you see what he means? By lust, he doesn't mean that normal, quite healthy psychological and biological urge that we have, which is a part of what it means to be human. Rather, he means to treat another person, another human being, as though that one, him or her, was a thing, something to be used, exploited, manipulated for our own purposes, to thingize, if you will, another person. In Forrest Carter's The Education of Little Tree, there's a remarkable exchange between Little Tree, story of a little Cherokee boy growing up in North Carolina who lived with his grandparents. And there's an exchange between Little Tree and his grandma, as he calls her. She's trying to teach him how to value things properly, how to understand things. And she says this, "Little Tree, everybody has two minds. One of the minds has to do with the necessaries for body living. You use it to figure out how to get shelter, what to eat, and such like that for the body. But you also have another mind which has nothing at all to do with things like that. It's the spirit mind." And then she says, "If you only use the body-living mind to think greedy or mean, if you're always cutting at folks with it or figuring out how to make profit off of them, then what you'll do is shrink up your spirit mind to the size no bigger than a hickory nut. And then when you die, the body-mind dies with you. Only the spirit mind goes on a-living. And if you only think with your body-mind all of your life, there you'll be, stuck with a spirit mind no bigger than a hickory nut." And then she says this, "Little Tree, that's how you become dead people. You don't have to be dead in your body to be dead people. All you have to do," she says, "is to let your spirit mind shrink up to the size of a hickory nut." Dead people, she says. Well, they're easy to spot. When people look at a woman and see only dirty, when they look at other people and see nothing but bad, when they see a tree and see nothing but lumber and profit, they're dead people walking around. Someone strikes you on the cheek. Some Roman soldier comes up to you and demands that you carry his pack. What do you see? Do you even see a person at all? Or would you like for a moment just to be the Terminator? Look again. Jesus says, look again. Because how you look determines what you do. A few years ago, when I was still teaching at the faculty of Midwestern Baptist Seminary in Kansas City, I was invited to the city of Chillicothe, Missouri, where there I was to conduct a Bible study, a regional Bible study clinic for ministers. One of the participants arrived late, after I'd already begun, sat near the back, crossed his legs, crossed his arms, his body language said it all. "I don't want to be here, I don't like you, and I don't believe anything you're saying." And he just sat there and glared at me the whole time. We finally reached a natural breaking point in the presentation, and I asked for questions. Several pastors in the audience asked good questions. Some dialogue ensued. Then in a tone of voice that sounded more like he was talking to an IRS examiner than to a seminary professor, he fired a question at me. Actually, it wasn't a question. It was a pontification. It was a statement, which essentially was more of an expression of his total disdain for me and his total disregard of everything I had said than it was a question. I could feel my defenses rising. I finally rummaged around in what he had said, trying to find a question, and I found one that I thought I could answer, and so I did the best I could to try to take him seriously and answer his question. We broke for lunch. When we did, I made a beeline for him. I sat down right beside him and started eating my lunch with him. He looked at me rather sheepishly, after a few moments of silence and said, "You know, I hope you didn't think I was angry with you by my comments." I said, No. I've never met you before today. And I'm fairly confident I've done nothing that would merit your anger. But you are angry. And I'd like to talk with you about it." My honesty totally disarmed him. And for an hour, outgushed pain and confusion and frustration, he began to share with me difficulty and woundedness and scars that had nothing to do with me or anything I was saying, but was baggage, agenda he had brought with him that day. And we talked and we prayed and we shared. And a friendship was born out of that encounter, which continues still. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't. Martin Luther King Jr. treated Bull Connors with respect and openness, and Connors beat his head in. Hear me. I am not saying that we should try Jesus' way because it works. Turn the other cheek. Go the second mile. Return good for evil. Because if you do, you'll be better off. That's not what I'm saying. That is not what Jesus says. Jesus never says, "Turn the other cheek because it works." He says, "Turn the other cheek because it's right." Your conduct, he says, is not determined by how other people treat you. Your conduct is determined by your Father in heaven, who I remind you sends His rain to fall on the just and on the unjust and causes His sun to shine on the good and the bad. He determines your conduct, not the other person. You want it straight? When Luke gives his version of the sermon and he summarizes what Jesus is trying to say with one clear sentence, he gives us what is probably the most radical statement in the New Testament. It is this: God is kind to the ungrateful and the selfish. Look again. Neither your friends nor your enemies dictate your ethics. We are called to be God's people. We are called upon to look at everyone and everything around us with the eyes of Christ. No excuses, no exceptions. In a little book called City Streets, City People, Michael Christensen tells of his experiences in living and working with Mother Teresa and her sisters of Calcutta, who work, as you know, with the poorest of the poor there. The overpopulation, the poverty, the cruel caste system makes Calcutta a place of unparalleled human misery. The poor of Calcutta are literally the forgotten poor, except for Mother Teresa and her sisters. They literally pick up people who are dying in the gutters of Calcutta and nurse them back to health, if possible, and if not, give them a place of warmth and care and security in which to die. Michael had only been in Calcutta a few weeks before he had come to realize that, in his words, he had seen enough blood and ooze to last him a lifetime. He confessed he never dreamed that such human degradation and misery existed. He'd never seen anything like that. Just the day before, he was walking along with Mother Teresa, and there lying in the streets was a child without hands and feet. The rats had eaten away the child's hands and feet. And Mother Teresa scoops up the child and takes him home. One morning just after Mass, when he felt he could take it no more, he was sitting down on a bench with Mother Teresa talking with her. He looked at her and said, "How can you do this? How do you do this day after day and go out there and face this and come back and then go out again and face it again? How do you do it? How do you look into those hopeless faces knowing that the most you can do is to ease their suffering and let them die in peace with some semblance of human dignity, and then get up the next morning and do it again? How do you do it?" And she looked at him and said, "Michael, did you see Jesus today?" And he said, "See Jesus? I saw only death and pain and suffering. I didn't see Jesus." And then she said, "When we love the poor, Michael, we do not see the poor. at least not at first. First, we see Jesus. We are not social workers here, Michael. We are ministers of the love of Christ. What we do for Jesus. And when we pick up a body out of the street and nurture him back to health, what we do for Jesus. What we do to Jesus. It is His face that we see in the faces of the poorest of the poor. And then she said this, Michael, let me see your hand. And he stuck out his hand and she said, Michael, the gospel of Jesus Christ is written on the fingers of your hand. And then pointing to his fingers individually, slowly, deliberately, she said, you did it to me. And then she took his fingers and pushed them together and she said, Michael, behold the five wounds of Jesus. And he said, I thought about the two in his hands and the two in his feet and the one in his side. And then she took his fingers and placed them into the palm of his hand, his other hand. And she said, Michael, this is Christ's love for you, pouring out into your life. And then she reached up and she closed his fist around his fingers and she said, Michael, this is the Sacred Heart of Jesus, which says, I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and in prison and you came to me. I was in the gutter and you picked me up. And then she looked at him and said, Michael, at the end of everything, your five fingers will either excuse you or accuse you of having done it to the least of these. You did it to me. Sisters and brothers, we are called to be God's people. To look at everything and everyone with the eyes of Christ. To live this sermon not because it works, but because it's right. No excuses. No exceptions. Now I know that's a tall order. I know that it sounds impossible. It seems impractical, not very realistic. As a matter of fact, when you think about it, it creates a little cognitive dissonance, doesn't it? Look again. Look carefully. Because how you look just may make all the difference in the world. Isn't that true? Father, bless your word this day. Wherever it is preached, wherever it is lived, to the end that it might be accorded lodging in the hearts of many. To your glory and our salvation. Amen.